Hello and welcome to Inside Europe, the weekly current affairs podcast and radio program from DW, Germany's international broadcaster. My name is Charlie Shield, and this week Kate and Laura have kindly let me take over the show to bring you an environment special. And strap in, because we're going to explore the magical, ever mysterious world of fungi together.
It's almost paradoxical because they're so vast and they underlie so many processes that sometimes we don't even notice they're there. It's like not noticing our own breath.
Coming out of a cave exploration trip, we found not only novel species, but really species with potential impact for broader industries.
All of that coming up on Inside Europe. This week, we open with a deep dive into fungi. That marvellous, mostly hidden kingdom that basically made life on land possible, continues to nourish the soil beneath our feet, and in its darker forms can also be highly, highly dangerous. We get into the weeds, the how and the why, in this next story, which was put together by my colleagues Natalie Muller and Neil King over at DW's environment podcast, Living Planet.
The land here is barren, harsh, and hostile. There's no vegetation in sight. The only plants that exist live in the ocean. But that's all about to change. This is planet Earth around 500 million years ago. A major shift is underway. At this point in history, plants are preparing to move from water and onto land. But it's not going to be easy.
What people don't know is that the first land plants, they didn't even have proper root systems.
Without roots, how would they absorb nutrients and feed themselves? Well, they're going to need help from an organism with a special talent for getting at the good stuff locked away in the rocky surface. Fungi.
Fungi have a sort of a magic power where they can digest their food outside of their bodies. So they actually exude enzymes and chemicals to break down rocks. And as the fungi digested rocks, they started feeding some of this digested nutrients to plants.
Toby Kiers is a professor of evolutionary biology at the Free University in Amsterdam.
Plants depended solely on fungi to sort of act as a root system for millions of years. You know, roots, plant roots are kind of a new evolutionary innovation.
The first land plants team up with fungi and start trading with them in order to survive. A you scratch my back, I'll scratch yours kind of arrangement.
And that was the beginning of this evolutionary innovation, this one partnership that led to a 90% reduction in atmospheric CO2 as plants started colonizing land and using that CO2 to make sugars and fats that they would then feed to the fungi to get at those rock nutrients.
This special partnership was crucial for the success of early land plants. They flourished and evolved, triggering a drastic transformation. The planet began to turn green. Ecosystems emerged. The composition of the atmosphere changed, becoming rich in oxygen, while carbon dioxide levels dropped by 90%, creating an environment that would allow animals to evolve on land as well.
Fungi lie at the base of life on Earth. Actually, what of much we see today around ecosystems, we actually owe to fungi, you know, from wolves to redwoods. It's the partnership between the ancestors of mycorrhizal fungi and aquatic plants that helped build our terrestrial ecosystems.
Without fungi, we wouldn't be here. All these millions of years later, that special partnership between fungi and plants endures. Today, most plants still depend on fungi in the soil for survival, to feed them nutrients and protect them from disease. And that's just one class of fungi. Fungi also give us food, like mushrooms, and life-saving medicines. They can digest pollutants, and their ability to lock away carbon underground also offers a solution to climate change. So, as you can tell from that still very incomplete list, fungi are major players on this earth, and we ignore their potential, both the good and bad, at our peril. This is Living Planet. My name is Neil King, and on this week's show, we're going deep into the truly amazing world of fungi. When you hear the word fungus, what comes to mind? Well, maybe you're thinking about those semicircular growths on tree trunks in the forest, or some mold on a piece of fruit, or even a nasty skin infection like athlete's foot. These are all part of the fungus kingdom. Yeasts, molds, and perhaps best well known, mushrooms. Mushrooms are the fruits of fungi that you see growing above ground. But most of the time, fungi take the form of mycelium, a root-like structure that looks a bit like tiny threads branching out, absorbing nutrients from the environment. They might seem like plants because they don't move around much and often grow in soil, but fungi actually have more in common with animals because they also have to find food and use enzymes to break it down. Fungi are often invisible to the human eye, and out of sight, they're performing an essential role in nature, breaking down organic matter and orchestrating the trade and flow of nutrients in the environment.
Wood wouldn't rot and release nutrients without fungi. There'd be no soil without fungi. They seem to weave their way into everything. And it's almost paradoxical because they're so vast and they underlie in so many processes that sometimes we don't even notice they're there. It's like not noticing our own breath.
There are around 150,000 species of fungi that have been formally identified. But estimates suggest there could be more than 2.5 million out there. That means more than 90% of all fungal species are still unknown to science, and that new discoveries are happening all the time. It's June 2020. And deep inside a cave, about an hour's drive from Kunming City in southern China, a research team has come to search for fungi. There's some old wood on the ground, dead insects and bat droppings. The team from the Kunming Institute of Botany has collected some samples to test back at the lab.
We were quite deep down in a cave, and I found a small piece of styrofoam that had blown in or washed in and was sitting in a sump in the bottom of this cave.
Peter Mortimer is a professor at the Kunming Institute of Botany, focusing on fungi and fungal ecology. He is originally from South Africa, and besides fungi, he's also passionate about caves.
And I could see there was a bit of black on the surface of the styrofoam, and so we thought we would see if that is a mold and what it's doing, and it turned out to be quite an interesting find. So we studied the fungi growing on that styrofoam and found it was a new species to science.
And that wasn't all. It turned out this new species of fungi also had the ability to digest the styrofoam, the plastic it was growing on.
Coming out of a cave exploration trip, we found not only novel species, but really species with potential impact for broader industries. So that kind of stands out in my mind as an example of why we should study unexplored habitats.
Peter has been living in Kunming, Yunnan province for more than a decade. In that time, the teams he's worked with have discovered hundreds of new species. And that's perhaps not as surprising as you might think, because Yunnan has an incredibly rich biodiversity when it comes to fungi.
We've described more than 1,000 new species now. So it's mind-blowing how much we are finding here. We're really scratching the surface of what we're finding and what is known. Arguably, it is the most biodiverse place. You've got alpine mountains above 5,000 meters elevation to the north, and a few hundred kilometers south, you're in tropical rainforest. So all these habitats and everywhere in between means there's opportunity and niches for speciation and the development of sort of fungal diversity. There's about 850 species of edible mushrooms in Yunnan, and globally there's only about 2,100. So
fungi and mushrooms play an important role in China, as key ingredients in Chinese cuisine and traditional medicine. And they're big for the economy too. China is the world's biggest mushroom producer.
If you want to put it in perspective, the Chinese produce, harvest and consume about 70% of the world's mushrooms. It ranges from fungi like the caterpillar fungus, which is harvested usually above 4,000 meters in elevation, so really in sort of high altitude meadows. This can be incredibly valued. I think we said it's up to $60,000 a kilo. But there's other mushrooms. Matsutake can fetch $3,000 or $4,000 a kilo at the start of the season. And areas that produce matsutake get sort of violently protected. There's bear traps and vicious dogs that are put in the forest. Like, the locals really guard their natural resources, the mushrooms. And that's their livelihoods. It's their annual income. You can go to some towns in Yunnan. That's all they do. It's mushroom trade, mushroom restaurants, guest houses aimed at mushroom tourism. Streets are named after mushrooms. It's crazy. Mushroom fever is very high. So interesting place to be.
Edible mushrooms and truffle are a valuable source of food for us humans. But we also rely on fungi for many other edible products, like yeast to bake bread, or to ferment beer, wine, vodka, and soy sauce. It's a fungus, Penicillium roqueforti, that creates the unique flavor and texture of blue cheeses, such as Roquefort and Stilton. And can you guess what we get from the fungus Penicillium camemberti? Well, it's a bit of a giveaway, isn't it? It's the rind on soft cheeses such as brie and camembert. Fungi also gave us the antibiotic penicillin, which revolutionized modern medicine. They've also been used to develop medication to lower cholesterol and immunosuppressant drugs, used to enable organ transplants. Enzymes produced by fungi are used industrially. Fungi have also been employed as pesticides and in the production of biodiesel.
Most people can't conceive the role that fungi play across different industries. You would see it for baking and brewing in your yeasts or mushrooms that you eat. The range of sort of things in your daily life that mushrooms or fungi contribute to, I think, would blow people away. The one example I find amazing is there's an enzyme out of a certain fungus that's used to make Lego, the building blocks children play with. Like, fungi touch on so many different aspects of our lives that we're unaware of.
The fungi facts do not end there. Stay tuned for more after this short break.
So it's clear that fungi are incredibly versatile, and we rely on them in so many ways. Take mycorrhizal fungi. This is the fungi that forms partnerships with plant roots in the soil. We heard about them at the top of the show. Well, 90% of plants depend on this fungi to survive. This network, sometimes cleverly called the wood wide web, is also used by trees to share resources with each other. And they've been shown to use it to receive advance warnings of threats. Toby says these fungi, building networks underground, can also be powerful allies in the fight against climate change. Because mycorrhizal fungi act as a kind of vacuum to draw carbon into soil systems, keeping it out of the atmosphere.
And this is where we say fungi are more than just organisms, right? They're creating this underground infrastructure that helps soils actually store this massive amount of carbon.
Toby co-authored a recent study published in the journal Current Biology that found the world's plants transfer around 13 billion tons of carbon to soil fungi each year. It's enough to cancel out the annual carbon emissions from China, the world's biggest emitter.
Soils in general, we know they store about 75% of all terrestrial carbon. And fungi, they're like the gateway of that carbon to the soil. And they play a major role in making that carbon drawdown happen. Just as trees are built of carbon, fungi, these fungal mycorrhizal fungal networks, are built of carbon. The second thing they do is so cool is they make sort of specific compounds. And these are compounds that are tough, organic things that they make the soil stronger. They make aggregates, which are sort of chunky bits of soil that act as a stable carbon reservoir. So it reduces erosion and maintains soil structure. It makes the soil sticky.
Underground fungi also hold soils together, preventing erosion, and they increase the volume of water soil can retain, which is important during drought or flooding and for reducing stress that the trees might face in times of climate change. But this underground fungi is at risk.
Mycorrhizal fungi are threatened by agricultural expansion, by deforestation, by urbanization. If you're putting concrete over underground ecosystems, you're going to really destroy the biodiversity that's there. It's worrying. I mean, the data are there. Scientists have been sort of trying to sound the alarm on the threats to underground ecosystems for decades.
More than 90% of the Earth's topsoil could be degraded by 2050, according to the United Nations. It says one soccer pitch of Earth erodes every 5 seconds. Logging can decrease the abundance of mycorrhizal fungi by as much as 95%, and intensive farming practices and use of chemicals like fungicides can also disrupt fungal networks.
This is what we're worried about, is what is going to happen to above ground biodiversity and stability, these ecosystems, if we lose the foundation of the soil, if we lose these mycorrhizal networks. You know, we call mycorrhizal networks the coral reefs of the soil because they support so much biodiversity and life. And it's hard to know what's going to happen.
Toby is also the executive director of an organization called SPUN, which stands for the Society of the Protection of Underground Networks. The group is currently working to map fungal networks around the world and advocate for their protection.
Sometimes it really feels like a race against time. I mean, it's about 99.9% of the Earth's surface that still needs to be sampled. But some of this biodiversity is disappearing, and so the urgency is quite real. The good news is that there's hope. I mean, these organisms, they are resilient. We do these experiments in the lab, for example, where we actually use a laser and we cut them very finely, and we can see that depending on the conditions, they can actually fuse back together if the disturbance isn't too great. So, you know, there are ways that these organisms, they're very resilient. They've been around for hundreds of millions of years.
The world of fungi is varied and complex, and while these organisms underpin life on Earth, fungi can also cause us harm. David Denning, a professor of infectious diseases in global health at the University of Manchester in the UK, says around 3.8 million people die globally every year as a result of fungal infections. That's more than malaria. But many of these cases go undetected.
So one of the reasons why we think there are many more deaths than there have been before is because the diagnosis has just been missed completely. The second problem is that they usually, not always, but usually complicate other diseases. So if you have leukemia or you've had a transplant and then you get a fungal infection and you die, it's attributed to the leukemia or to the transplant, not to the fungus.
The World Health Organization has sounded the alarm about the issue. In 2022, for the first time, it released a list of fungi considered to pose the most danger to humans. Among those of most concern was Aspergillus fumigatus, a mold found in soil and decaying leaves, capable of producing life-threatening infections in people with weakened immune systems. Another one on the WHO's list, a yeast pathogen called Candida auris, was first identified in 2008 and has since spread around the world. Such fungi can also be difficult to treat because they've become increasingly resistant to the antifungal drugs. That's mainly due to the use of fungicides to spray crops. And there's also the possibility that climate change is making the situation worse, allowing some pathogens to adapt to higher temperatures and spread to people. Here's David again.
There are a few fungi, and probably Candida auris, which has gone across the world as a multi-resistant bloodborne infection, was driven by warmer climates in seawater. Another issue is the extreme weather that we're getting, which is causing a lot of damage to housing and flooding and other things. So people are getting exposed to many more fungi in damp, mouldy houses. And then the other thing is issues around travel and migrations. So as the world gets hotter, some places in the world are become uninhabitable or they ran out of water. And so we're seeing already, and we will see many, many more mass migrations of people, and they will take fungal disease with them.
Humans aren't the only ones affected by these harmful fungi. Thousands of fungus species can cause disease in plants. The fungal disease rice blast destroys up to 35% of the world's rice crop each year. Fungi has also decimated populations of bats and frogs. So the consequences for food security and biodiversity can be serious. So where does that leave us? As dangerous as they can be for some, fungi also present huge opportunities. We've learned that modern medicine relies on fungi. They keep trees healthy and can even help us sequester heat-trapping CO2. Some fungi have the ability to break down pollutants, such as crude oil in the environment, for example, after an oil spill, a process known as mycoremediation. Fungi have also been shown to digest plastic, as we heard from Peter in Kunming earlier in the show. But he thinks there's still a lot of untapped potential.
The mainstream adoption of mycelium-based packaging, replacing styrofoam and plastic packaging with mycelium materials, that is definitely the biggest point of impact we can make with current technology. A company like Ecovative, which pioneered it, and IKEA recently gave a commitment to transition and to include mycelium-based packaging for all their products. That's a step in the direction we need to be going, and I think this is an easy win that's available to us now. We need to look at the economics of it, scaling of such industries to be competitive and viable against such well-established industries in plastics and styrofoam. But the technology is there, and I think the shift will happen.
Mycelium-based materials can also be used to replace energy-intensive building materials in the construction sector or unsustainable materials in the fashion industry.
Then there's huge potential to revolutionize textiles and fashion, the electronics industry even. So I think we will see a whole change and revolution in a number of industries, but we have the technology, the economics needs to follow.
Welcome back to Inside Europe, the weekly current affairs podcast and radio program from DW, Germany's international broadcaster. My name is Charlie Shield, and I'm coming to you from Berlin. I'm taking over Inside Europe this week with an environment special, courtesy of Inside Europe's sister podcast, Living Planet, which is where you can usually find me. And next up, I'm taking you to Norway, the country beloved for its pristine fjords and forests, its herring, hiking, and increasingly in recent decades, its climate credentials. But this image is curiously at odds with how the country built and continues to build its wealth, which is with a whole lot of oil and gas exports that are contributing to a global climate disaster. Earlier this year, I got in contact with one Norwegian who'd started to question his role in this whole story. That then opened up a bigger story about the climate paradox shaping this country's future and the world's energy transition. Here is that story in a deep dive I produced for Living Planet.
For quite a few years, I was very quiet about it. I didn't tell anybody, but gradually it just grew and grew. And that was it.
Some years ago, working as a geologist in southwest Norway, Daniel Solien's world as he knew it began to slowly unravel.
I was starting to read these books about cognitive bias.
At first, it was just about improving his work, building geological models for Equinor, Norway's oil giant. Daniel was keen to challenge any irrational thinking that might be skewing his models.
I wanted to become better at my job. Suddenly I had a bit of time on my hands and I started reading about it.
But page after page, he found something bigger was starting to shift. What had started as a professional curiosity soon spilled over into other parts of his life, until he found himself questioning more than just his geological models.
And that became quite difficult. So I got really concerned about what we were doing, really. About the whole oil endeavour, if you like, what are we actually doing?
What they were doing was exploring for and extracting oil and gas from Norway's continental shelf to export around the world for energy. And in the process, as Daniel came to realise, changing the face of the planet.
A new study finds that hurricanes in 2020 produced more rain due to climate change, a trend that's...
The island of Madagascar is facing a famine that the UN says is caused by climate change.
Shows the rising water levels of glacial lakes over the past 2 months. Warming temperatures are allowing more of
major oil and gas companies testified today about their company's roles in greenhouse gas emissions.
That did not sit right with him. Working for the Norwegian oil company was very well respected and very well paid. And no one else around him really seemed to be asking these questions. But as time wore on, Daniel found the voice inside, the one asking why, just grew louder and louder.
It transformed me somehow. And as time went past, that really bugged me. I don't see that things are changing. And by then, I was really, really frustrated that nothing was happening.
Eventually, in mid-2024, still working for Equinor, Daniel joined a movement.
Because I was working for the oil industry, I thought somebody like me should really speak up. When they then asked me if I wanted to come along, I said yes. Kårstø is just north of Stavanger, so it takes about an hour and a half to drive there. And I was asked to pick up Greta Thunberg on the way up.
If you're wondering, that is the Greta Thunberg that Daniel's talking about. She was part of the same movement, and she happened to be staying nearby at the time, so he agreed to collect her.
She's not from here, of course, she's Swedish, but she was living with somebody on the island, so went to pick her up, which was nice. We had a nice conversation in the car. You need to take a ferry to get there because you have to go to the other side of the county. And then we put on our rain gear because we're expecting it to rain all day. And then we drove to Kårstø. We came down to the one main gate, and of course that was quite, I've never been in a protest like this or action at all, so that was of course quite nerve-wracking.
Daniel and Greta and 40 to 50 others were joining an Extinction Rebellion protest against the Norwegian government's ongoing support for the oil and gas industry. It was at a port where ships carrying fossil fuels come to fuel up. Some protesters were blocking the terminal so that the ships couldn't dock to fill up their tanks. Daniel was not involved in that part of it, though.
I was just standing by the roadside because I was going to be the spokesperson. I spoke to quite a few newspapers. I was on the national TV. They interviewed me.
The headlines were striking. Oil worker joins a demonstration against oil industry. Here's Daniel on the evening news.
Jeg føler bare at jeg må gjøre det.
Despite the fact that I love my job, I am here because the situation is so serious and far too little is being done. I'm worried about my children's future. We need Equinor and the politicians to create a plan for phasing out oil and gas now. I can no longer just sit on the sidelines. I have to take action.
Several months after joining the protest, Daniel ended up having to quit his job with Equinor. He and the company made a deal, and he can't say much more about it.
Now comes a bit I can't really talk too much about, because that...
Months down the track, he's still looking for work. He's currently retraining to become a teacher. And that conflict, the one that made him question his job and drove him to speak out, he still feels it all around him. And there just aren't that many people that want to talk about it.
It's a silent taboo. It's just not talked about.
The silence around Norway's oil and what it means for the planet's future doesn't just exist within the country, but outside of it too. Better known for its fjords, its nature lovers and social welfare, Norway often escapes scrutiny for its stance on oil and gas. But when you drill down, here are the facts. Norway is one of the world's major fossil fuel producers. It's Europe's biggest oil and gas supplier. Like Russia, Qatar, and Saudi Arabia, it's gotten extremely wealthy off of giant oil and gas reserves. Those riches have created the world's largest sovereign wealth fund, which is heavily invested in the global fossil fuel trade. Today, Norway is investing more than ever in its oil and gas industry, all the while exporting hundreds of millions of tons of CO2 emissions. But unlike other petrostates, Norway has also built a reputation as a climate leader for its EVs, its hydropower, and its heat pumps. So how exactly does that square with its fossil fuel expansion? And how did this nation, so deeply invested in petroleum, manage to garner such a clean, green image?
They just don't see the contradiction.
It's not the common interests any longer, but it's still perceived in this way.
We're about to run ourselves off the cliff. For what?
As we'll discover, Norway's story is not just about Norway. It's about the rest of us too. Way back when, in the 1950s, not many people were confident the seas north of Norway concealed rich oil and gas deposits. But after a couple of false starts, drillers eventually uncovered what was to become the bedrock of the Norwegian economy.
The oil was discovered in the late 60s, early 70s on the Norwegian continental shelf, and the investments were enormous.
Elin Lerum Boassen is a professor of political science at the University of Oslo.
And I also have a part-time position at CICERO, Center for International Climate Research.
Around the same time as these oil discoveries, scientists were beginning to reckon with an alarming truth.
Fossil fuels, when burned, release carbon dioxide into the atmosphere. Researchers say increasingly large amounts of CO2 are accumulating in the atmosphere. They fear the Earth will gradually become warmer, causing as yet uncertain but possibly disruptive changes in the Earth's climate.
And it was against this backdrop, in 1981, that Norway swore in its first female prime minister, Gro Harlem Brundtland.
Now, in Norway, there's another Iron Lady of Europe, Prime Minister Gro Harlem Brundtland. And she
has a doctor by training and previously the country's first female environment minister, Brundtland became known for linking public health and the environment. she's widely remembered as spearheading sustainable global development, as chair of the UN Commission that led to the 1992 Earth Summit in Rio de Janeiro.
Gro Harlem Brundtland, famous Norwegian Prime Minister, had a very central role in placing climate on the global agenda.
We can solve the problems of environmental concerns by starting a new era of growth based on sustainable development.
And while internationally she was busy championing a healthy climate, at home in Norway, Brundtland's government was greenlighting oil and gas drilling in the North and Barents Seas.
At that stage, the government had already invested a lot in oil. It would have been a tragedy economically for Norway if we had stopped oil and gas exploration.
So they carried on. And to date, billions of barrels of oil have been pumped from the Norwegian continental shelf, in turn pumping billions of Norwegian kroner into the country's sovereign wealth fund, which is today worth an estimated $2 trillion, for a population of about 5.5 million people.
She allowed for increased extraction of fossil fuels, and there was really no mention of this contradiction.
Andreas Brandøy is a climate and energy advisor at Greenpeace Norway. From his perspective, Brundtland's leadership was the beginning of a powerful, enduring narrative crafted by the Norwegian government. One that made it look as though they were serious about the climate, while never truly contemplating an end to fossil fuel production, the very industry undermining sustainable global development.
The Norwegian government has been very, very good at communicating, branding the country as an environmentally sustainable country.
Andreas says they've been so successful at doing this, he believes that's partly why so many Norwegians don't question oil.
The government and the oil industry are deeply intertwined. There's a trend of politicians going back and forth between oil companies or the oil industry lobby organizations and back into party politics. It is just not controversial in Norway to work with fossil fuels, to open up new oil fields, despite this clearly being a violation of the climate commitments that we've made.
At first glance, the country's sustainability efforts can look pretty good. On average, Norwegians emit 7 tons of CO2 per year. That's half of the US average. And that's mostly because the country has about 50% renewable energy in its energy mix, which comes mostly from hydropower. Since the 1990s, Norway's electricity has been almost entirely clean thanks to the hydropower. Norway also has the highest per capita rate of heat pump installation in Europe. And yes, it famously also leads the world in per capita electric vehicle sales. Almost 100% of new cars bought in Norway are electric. Norway was also one of the first countries to introduce a carbon tax on its oil drilling in 1991, and it currently has one of the highest nominal carbon taxes in the world. Then there's the Nordic nations' enthusiastic support for international climate negotiations. It's ratified every major global climate agreement since 1993, as well as contributed billions to tropical rainforest protection and given generously to the UN climate negotiations to help support ongoing work and low-income country participation.
We have always supported strong international agreements on climate.
But, Elin says, peel back the layers on these efforts and Norway's reputation as a climate leader is less impressive than it seems at face value.
Also because international climate politics have been challenging for several decades, it has not been very hard to be a leader, especially in the UN-related forums. And it has been the backbone of Norwegian climate governance for a long time to invest in climate reductions elsewhere.
This strong support for reducing emissions abroad, she explains, was a strategy developed around the time the Brundtland government was trying to juggle its investments in oil and gas with its goal to appear as a trailblazer in sustainable development.
So we have to find a way to align these interests, and that's why we very early on promoted emissions trading.
Since the 1990s, Norway's been a strong advocate for things like emissions trading and carbon offsets. So in practice, that means either buying credits to keep emitting or paying for projects elsewhere designed to soak up carbon. We've actually got an episode all about that in our feed. It's called Can Planting Trees Really Offset My Flight Emissions? These tools are widely used by governments around the world to meet climate targets. But they're also widely criticised because they don't reduce emissions at the source, and carbon offsets in particular have been tied to corruption and questionable accounting. For Norway, though, they've served a specific purpose. As Erlend points out, they've effectively allowed the country to meet its climate targets without having to take a good hard look at its oil and gas production.
The reason that Norway has met its, or at least some of its climate targets have always been that we have been very willing to invest in emission reductions outside of Norway.
Norway has also spent years promoting another controversial carbon policy, carbon capture and storage. The idea behind it is to trap CO2 from power plants and heavy industries and bury it deep underground. But its track record so far is nothing to write home about. Many carbon capture projects emit more than they manage to capture and are extremely expensive.
It has taken really a long time. A lot of ministers have invested incredible amounts of time and energy to promote carbon capture and storage. So it's like an elephant giving birth to a mouse kind of situation. So this has been really hard, and yet it's a bit unclear what the results will be.
Earlier this year, Equinor was forced to retract claims it had made about its flagship carbon capture project after reporting revealed that it had stored only one-tenth of the carbon that it had claimed to. All the while, Norway has kept expanding its oil and gas industry. In 2023, the government approved nearly 20 new projects, worth nearly $20 billion. Since the 1970s, the country has exported hundreds of billions of barrels of oil equivalent. In 2024 alone, they shipped off 87 billion barrels worth. When all that is burnt, it adds up to billions of tons of CO2, pollution that far outweighs Norway's domestic footprint.
The emissions from the oil and gas that we produce are almost exclusively sent to other countries where they create pollution there. This, of course, makes no difference for the climate. Like, still, these emissions will affect me and everyone else in Norway just as much. But because they don't show up when we take account of our domestic emissions, it can seem lower than what it really is.
In fact, the annual CO2 from Norway's fossil fuel exports is around 10 times higher than its domestic emissions. Per capita, that makes Norway the world's second largest emitter after Qatar. And that really puts the country's pro-climate policies into perspective. Take the electric vehicles. Norway currently leads the world in EV adoption, and switching away from gas-fueled cars has helped them reduce transport emissions at home. But those savings have been in the order of millions. About 4 million tonnes of CO2 have been saved by electric vehicles in Norway. And although that is better than nothing, when you compare it to the billions of tonnes of CO2 emitted by burning the oil and gas they sell, it is just a drop in the bucket.
We talk so much about slightly improving the energy efficiency of cars, and so little about the absolute biggest contribution to climate change.
And EVs have taken off largely because they don't pose a major threat to the contributor that Andreas is talking about, the oil industry.
It has been a big success. This has not resulted from a major plan from Norwegian politicians. Most of the policies for electrical vehicles have kind of sneaked in when the green political parties, they have lost kind of the big discussions on oil, gas, bigger discussions on transport infrastructure, and then they have gained support for electrical vehicle policies.
It's only in recent years that Norway's domestic emissions, which come mostly from the fossil fuel industry and transport, have started to fall, thanks to the EVs. And while you could argue that there wasn't much fat to trim because Norway already had clean hydropower, Erlend says that excuse only goes so far.
Yeah, that's a very popular argument from Norwegian politicians. But all countries will argue that Oh, my country is so special. We have special conditions that makes the climate transition much harder for us than for everyone else. So for Norway, we would have had to focus on other sectors than many other European countries, but we were not willing to do that.
And it appears the country is still unwilling. Today, the Norwegian government has no plan to phase out oil and gas. This push for more fossil fuels has not gone unchallenged. In 2024, Andreas's team at Greenpeace Norway, along with the climate group Nature and Youth, took the government to court. They argued that the approvals for three North Sea oil and gas fields were illegal because the government had not considered the future emissions from burning all of the oil and gas. The Oslo District Court agreed, declaring the approvals invalid. That case is now under appeal and awaiting a ruling on just how far climate impact assessments must go.
Actually, one of the fields, the biggest one, called Yggdrasil, they even told the public that this will reduce global emissions. And we've shown in court that that is just not at all true. It will massively increase global emissions. And if the oil and gas from these three fields are being used over their lifetime, it will cause the premature death of over 100,000 people. And that is the type of information that we say should be open to the public. I don't think that Norwegians know that we can today calculate how many people will lose their lives because we are opening up this oil and gas field.
We'll be back in just a moment. And we're back. All this might sound like it's ignoring Norway's role as a key energy supplier to the world. Norwegian oil and gas have helped power homes, factories, and economies for decades. Hasn't it simply been answering the world's call for fossil fuels? Well, not exactly.
It's not true. It's not true that if we stop producing oil and gas, this will be purely replaced by other producers. There's been research into this. And it contradicts economic theory and empirical data on how markets respond to changes in production levels.
Research shows that producing more oil and gas actually drives up demand. And the only way to effectively reduce fossil fuel consumption is to cut production. No industry is more acutely aware of this than the fossil fuel industry itself. Oil and gas companies are keen to preserve demand for their products. And extensive reporting has shown that they actively lobby against investments and support for clean energy. So, by continuing to drill and pouring billions into new projects, Norway isn't meeting demand so much as it's creating it. Meanwhile, some countries are choosing a different path.
We are seeing a trend, which is not large enough, but we are seeing a trend internationally where countries are ramping down fossil fuel expansion on behalf of the climate. So Denmark is doing this. Costa Rica has vowed not to open new oil and gas fields. Greenland has done the same, and they have larger oil and gas reserves than Norway. The UK may be going down that path as well.
Europe is also set to move in a different direction. The EU wants to slash greenhouse gas emissions by 90% by 2040. The UK has pledged 80%. That's a decade before Norway expects its own oil and gas production to slow. And beyond Europe, recent data shows that China's widespread electrification and clean energy boom is creating the conditions for a global fossil fuel decline.
This will have massive implications for the demand for oil and gas. So I'm not saying that we should shut off the deliveries of oil and gas today, not at all. But I certainly think we should not be opening up new oil and gas fields or spend billions on exploring for new resources further and further north in the Arctic Sea, like we're doing right now.
And according to political scientist Erlen, far from leading the world on effective climate policy, Norway is betting its future on everyone else failing to act.
We do spend a lot of resources trying to identify new oil and gas fields. If you take climate seriously, we kind of bet on that we will not be required to actually reduce our emissions.
So what could an alternative path be? Both Andreas and Erlen point to Norway's Scandinavian neighbour.
Denmark has betted on increasingly strong and serious climate policies internationally. So their main economic strategy is to develop green industries, and this is how they plan to remain a wealthy country. So Norway has done the opposite.
Norway has the engineers, the technology, and it certainly has the capital. According to Andreas, a lot of what powers their oil industry could be shifted.
We could be the green and democratic provider of renewable energy and renewable industries. I mean, a lot of the same companies that are today building supply ships and equipment and supplying oil wells and oil platforms, they could be producing offshore wind. It is a lot of the same technology, a lot of the same skills, but if we do not start that transition now, we will be falling behind.
Back in southwest Norway, a year on from leaving Equinor, Daniel still isn't sure why he wrestled more with the cognitive dissonance than those around him.
I've spent an awful lot of time on thinking, why didn't I just ignore it? And I don't really have a very good explanation why I reacted differently to many. I don't know.
In oil-rich Stavanger, questioning the industry can mean questioning your community, your family, your entire way of life. But for Daniel, staying silent became impossible. And though he lost a well-paying job, he's convinced he made the right choice.
I don't really want to be part of a company that is all about growth and just profits. Now I've finally gotten out of that type of business. Even though I enjoyed the job, I want to make a positive contribution.
It's a message that he knows many of his former colleagues and fellow Norwegians aren't ready to hear. But Daniel believes that Norway's incredible wealth gives them a unique opportunity to lead the world away from fossil fuels rather than deeper into them.
I think Norway should, first of all, look at the science. And if you understand the science, you should work for change. And for me, arguments around have to think about the economy first, they are completely false. And we have lots of money. We should use that for better purposes.
Now that, he thinks, would be real climate leadership. And on that ponderous note, dear listeners, we're going to leave you. That story on Norway's climate paradox was produced by me, Charlie Shield, and it was edited by Neil King. It first aired on DW's environment podcast, Living Planet, which you can find on any and all good podcast platforms. If you don't want the conversation to end, you can always drop us a line at insideeurope@dw.com. Or, nowadays, you can also leave us a voice note at speakpipe.com/insideeurope. We can't wait to hear from you. Inside Europe comes to you from DW Studios in Germany. Thank you so much for listening.